You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
This is the Classic Auto Mall Podcast. Broadcast from the studios inside the Classic Auto Mall in Morgantown, Pennsylvania, just 1 hour west of Philadelphia at Pennsylvania Turnpike Exit 298. Featuring nearly 1,000 classic, vintage, and barn find vehicles for sale under one climate-controlled roof. Now, here's your host, Classic Auto Mall President, and the man with all the toys, Stuart Howden.
Well, surprise, it's not Stuart, it's me, J.R. Rush, your charming and delightful producer, engineer, and chief cook and bottle washer here at the Classic Auto Mall Podcast. We thought we'd share some best of moments with you. Portions of several interviews, not only from recent shows, but some classics, if you will, since it is the Classic Auto Mall. We thank you for listening. Make sure you like and subscribe on our YouTube channel, and keep looking for us wherever you listen to your podcasts. So without further ado, let's listen to our venerable host with a fascinating interview of a car collector and renowned music producer with some previously unheard comment. Here's the Classic Auto Mall president and Classic Auto Mall host, Stuart Howden.
In the studio with us, Obie O'Brien, who has worked with everybody but done a lot of work with John Bon Jovi from the Classic Auto Mall studio in beautiful sunny downtown Morgantown, Pennsylvania. Yeah, by the way, if those of you don't realize, this is a car show, but we've been talking music, but Obie is a car guy, too, and has been for a long time. There's a picture of you and Bon Jovi on the cover of Street Rod or Super Chevy magazine.
We were together on Rod and Custom.
Rod and Custom, that was it, sorry.
It's my 32 and his 57 right, Nomad, right. But his 70 Chevelle was in one of those Chevy magazines
right after we did it. How cool is that, though?
I'll tell you what. He loves that car.
Oh, I bet.
And it's great. It's got a 454 in it.
Right.
And, you know, it's got the cow induction. Right. And what a great car. And that thing, he takes it to his summer house
right.
and drives it when everybody in the town where he is in their little Range Rover or, you know, Bentley. And here comes the tops down, making all this noise.
Yeah, those rock stars.
Yep. But he's had some great cars over the years. He had a 58 Corvette.
Oh,
he had.
Love those.
I think it was a 69 Camaro. I mean, he had that 57 Nomad.
Right.
He had a Nomad that I was in love with.
Right.
And it was a 454.
Right.
Four-wheel disc brakes.
Nice. Good driver.
Yeah.
Good one to drive.
R700 overdrive tranny in it.
So you got modern conveniences, but with still the cool Nomad look.
And, you know, I've had a lot of cars over the years. And cars that I loved. I had a 63 Impala SS409 convertible.
What a great
that
car.
I bought off the lot in 1969 from a place called Dick Barone Chevrolet in Springfield, Pennsylvania, right outside of Philadelphia.
Right.
Farmer Dick Barone. I loved that car, and the engine blew up on the way back on the Atlantic City Expressway. We were playing in Summers Point,
Maryland. This was your band. This was the band that you were in.
Yeah. So we would play down the shore resorts in the summer, and someone had stolen the gauges out of it. Yeah.
That seems like a hard thing to steal.
So I put a clamp on the oil line because it was a mechanical. And the car, the thermostat locked up, and I didn't know it. And I'm going much faster than you were supposed to be going, Atlantic Expressway. And all of a sudden, I look at the rearview mirror, and there's smoke. And then all of a sudden, it starts bucking, and bang, right through the side of the block.
So how did you get home?
One of the other band guys was 20 minutes behind me. He came up and then called somebody. You know, you forget, no cell phones.
No cell phones.
This is 1970, maybe.
Right.
And we're on the side of the road in the Atlantic City Expressway. And, you know, I had my drums in the trunk.
Of course.
And part of it in the back seat. I'm on the side of the road, and I believe I had our bass player, Hugh McDonald.
Right.
Who, by the way, is the bass player in Bon Jovi right now. when Alec, the original bass player, retired, Hugh took over because Hugh had played on a lot of the records.
Right.
Amazing bass player.
Right.
So, and one of our bandmates was like, we left at the same time,
right.
But they're actually doing the speed limit.
You're flying.
Yeah.
The 409, which, and you had a fifth gear though, right?
Yeah.
That would have been nice. So how did you get the car home?
So he came and then he went to a payphone. He had two other people come and meet us.
Right.
Because they were staying at a hotel in Ocean City, right outside of Summers Point.
Right.
Right. So we got enough cars there. So we had to unload my drums. And now I'm thinking, you know, because my car was a convertible.
Right.
So I'm putting the convertible top up and I'm like, I just know this isn't good. I'm going to leave it on the side of the road.
Yeah.
And there was a place, they had a tow truck. And it was a payphone, and it was like 24 hour. And I called, and the guy actually came. It took him an hour and a half to get there.
Right.
One of the guys stayed with me, followed the truck. I went in the guy's truck with him, and they got my car, and they put it in like their impound lot.
Right.
And then 2 or 3 days later, when I get a tow truck from where I live, somebody I knew somebody that had a flatbed, we go down there. And I forget, it was like a $300 or $400.
Which was a lot of money.
A lot of money. And I think everybody I was with, we all chipped in. I said,
right.
You know, and then I got it back. And that car, unfortunately, sat on the side of the house for a year.
Oh. What are you going to do? You can't, you know.
You know, the engine was shot because the rod came right through the block.
Nice.
And I was like, you know, and then a friend of mine had a 348.
Right.
That, you know, 240 horsepower, whatever it was. He said, why don't you throw this in there? Because, you know, the valve covers look the same.
Yeah, exactly.
And I had finned valve covers. Right. Put it on nobody else. I go, I don't want to do it.
Right. Did you sell it to somebody?
I ended up selling the car as it was and getting nothing.
Right,
maybe
a couple hundred bucks. Right?
Maybe $200 or $300.
Do you have any idea where the car is today?
No idea.
Oh, wouldn't that be cool?
But you hope somebody
did the right thing.
Yeah.
Right? So you were a drummer.
Yeah.
And what was Atlantic City like in 1970? I
mean, we never did Atlantic City. We did like the Ocean City.
Right.
Summers Point.
Right.
Summers Point was the hot place.
Right.
Here because you had Bay Shores and Tony Marts, which were the big places.
Right.
We played down the street from them at a place called The Mug that it was just great. We had a horn band. So right. We had 9 or 10 people.
Playing covers or original?
Covers.
And Blood, Sweat, and Tears and stuff
Chicago,
like that.
Blood, Sweat, and Tears, The Electric Flag, which very few people aren't going to know.
I have no
idea. Mike Bloomfield was a guitar player who was an unbelievable guitar player.
Amazing guy.
But I'm going to tell you how many flights of stairs that I helped carry a Hammond C3 and two Leslies.
Oh, which way like?
Two 122 Leslies.
They both have mercury in them, right? they're just crazy.
I mean, you know, you're a kid. You don't know anybody. You would haul this stuff and have to walk up flights of stairs.
I remember doing the same thing. I was a roadie for a band back in the day, and we had Heavy Debbie, the big case that had all the metal microphone stands, lugging that thing up the back stairway of a...
It was... I don't... You know, but I will say this. It doesn't matter who John had in his band. That band would have been...
Successful.
He's focused. He's driven. He's just the... One of the greatest human beings I've ever met in my life.
How does a guy like that, when he gets to the twilight years of his career, is it a slow progression to, you know, you're not as famous as you were, not as much in the limelight as you were back when you were doing stadium tours, but he's still as well known as anybody on the planet, right? I mean, his fame hasn't diminished.
No, and here's the thing. It's not that he's, like, I look at him, you know, I've known him since he was 18, so we've been friends for 43 years.
Wow, yeah.
The thing is, what he has done to help people, his philanthropic, is unreal. He's got the Soul Kitchens where you can come. It doesn't matter if you have money. You can bring your family and in dignity, eat in a beautiful restaurant, beautiful food. What he's done in Philadelphia, you know, he partnered with Sister Mary Scullion, Project Home. The amount of housing units they have built together, what he's been able to do.
He'd be long remembered for that as much as he'll be remembered as a
absolutely. As a musician. I mean, he has done, and I've seen him change people's lives. And I'm not talking about, here's a check.
Right, right.
Hands on and help people out of incredibly difficult situations.
Wow. Do the right thing with these cars, people.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you, You hate to, because they really are works of art.
Absolutely.
You know,
and we're just stewards. We're just the keeper of the car for a period of time.
You know, and but it's that way with everything in our life. And because here's the thing, you know, everyone loves their house.
Sure.
Your house does not give a shit whether you live or die.
Never change anything.
And I throw money at my house, like, you know, and the thing was, I just put a big generator in at my house. Right. So we dug a hole for a 500-gallon propane tank. Right.
Of course.
And I was thinking about this, and I wrote the story of my house with a big magic marker on that tank saying,
bought it.
I put the date.
Right.
I said, we bought this house. I put my wife's name, my name. I put a story about this house, how we, you know, ripped it apart, rebuilt it, took 2 years.
God.
So, because at some point, somebody's going to dig that up. And then the whole history of that house is there because, you know, that's going to be someone else's home.
That's right.
And I hope that they get as much enjoyment out of that house as we're getting.
Absolutely.
Because everyone loves coming to my house.
Well, and there you go. And it's no different than the car. I mean, if you're passionate about something, and listen, at the end of the day, people say, oh, if you over-customize your house, then you'll do this and it won't be valuable. And well, I go, who cares?
I never cared about that.
Yeah, I don't care.
Like, you know, I remember I'm friends with the gentleman the real estate agent who found me the house.
Right.
And he's like, well, you know, you should put this many bedrooms for resale. I go, I'm going to be dead.
Yeah, I don't care.
We don't care about resale. We're going to have a house that we love every day.
Yeah.
Like I walk into my kitchen. First thing I do is turn the jukebox on in the morning. I put the Beatles. I put Elvis. I put the Drifters.
Right.
I eat my Honey Nut Cheerios and I go.
That's a plug for Honey Nut Cheerios. We get sponsorship money.
How bad can the day be?
Yeah. You're starting out the day.
Yeah.
And probably getting ready to go down to the studio, right?
Yeah.
And dink around there.
So cars and houses,
and
you want them, they should have a life.
They should have a life.
They should have a life.
Because they won't be yours forever.
Yeah.
And somebody else is going to enjoy it, you hope, and
you
appreciate
hope.
It for what you do.
And
listen, if you over-customize it, then the right person that does find it that wants it is going to be someone similar to you.
There's an ass for every seat.
With that, we will call it a day. Thank you so much for being on
the
show today.
Thanks for having me up here.
We'll do it again.
This place is great. I'll come back another time.
Yeah, please do. Once again, OB O'Brien in the studio with us today. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks, Stuart.
If you're a regular listener to the Classic Auto Mall Show, you know that we're really a lifestyle program that has a lot of fun with current events, music, entertainment, with a focus on classic cars. Well, recently, Stuart went down a rabbit hole and told us about his new boat, so we thought, why not give you a chance to name it? So if you have a suggestion, send it to us by August 25th at podcast@classicautomall.com. And our panel of Olympic-quality judges, Stuart, Steve, Randy, and me, JR, will select a winner and announce it on the Classic Auto Mall Show Labor Day weekend. The winner gets their choice of a Classic Auto Mall shirt or hat. We wanted to include a classic car, too, and if we decide to, we'll let you know. But right now, a shirt or a hat. So in the meantime, name Stuart's new boat, though we can't guarantee he'll paint it on there. And email it by August 25th, 2024 to podcast@classicautomall.com. Yar, matey.
If you have any questions or comments, contact us at classicautomall.com.
Since the 1960s, J.C. Taylor has been America's premier specialty insurance provider for classic cars, antique autos, modified, and custom vehicles. Our customers have trusted us to protect their prized possessions for more than six decades. For more information, or to receive a quote, contact our expert team today by calling 888-ANTIQUE or by visiting our website at jctaylor.com/awr. That's 888-268-4783. Or visit jctaylor.com/awr. Drive through time with peace of mind. J.C. Taylor.
If you love classic cars, you're going to want to listen to the Classic Car Show with Tom Cox and Richard Lentinello on America's Web Radio. Live every Saturday at 9 a.m. Eastern at americaswebradio.com. Or on demand on your favorite podcast app.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
This is the Classic Auto Mall Best Of. Now here's part of another interview from Classic Auto Mall president and host, Stuart Howden, talking about a car you might not be familiar with unless you saw the movie.
We have two special guests with us today. One in studio, Jeff Bleemeister, who's the executive director of the AACA Museum in Hershey, and Mark Lieberman. For lack of a better terminology, Mark, you're the Tucker Whiz expert guru. Is that fair?
I'll go with that, sure.
You know, Jeff and I had him on the show, probably one of our first shows, probably a year and a half or so ago, Jeff, and talking about the AACA Museum and all the wonderful things that you do. And it still continues just to grow and grow and grow. You guys are a success story in the museum world that not many people enjoy.
Yeah, I'm glad you see it that way. We agree. You know, re-advertised or branded ourselves last year as America's Transportation Experience.
Right.
2023 is an important year for us for many reasons. It's our 20th anniversary as a public museum.
Wow.
Which is fantastic. And we have a whole series of events planned for the year. But it's also the 75th anniversary of the launch of the Tucker 48, the Tucker automobile, which is iconic part of automotive history. And that's where Mark's going to come into this program today. You know, the
sure.
museum has the largest collection of Tucker automobiles and automobilia in one spot in the whole
right.
world.
Isn't it amazing how those were salvaged and saved? And, you know, we didn't know about collectability of cars back in the 40s. My goodness, nobody was thinking about that.
No, every one of those vehicles is accounted for.
Wow.
And most of them still exist, as Mark will tell you.
Right. And the reason that the AACA Museum kind of has a Tucker influence, but is it by happenstance or was it designed or how did that come about?
Years ago, before we actually built the museum, one of our founders, Bill Smith, AACA executive director
right.
at the time, developed a relationship with Mr. Kamek of Virginia. The Kamek family, he had collected three of the vehicles plus the blueprints, test engines, chassis, all
wow.
kinds of things. And their family put an addition on the building to house these things.
Right.
And when he passed away several years ago, the collection came to us.
That's fantastic.
And we've added more. You know, Mark is with us because Mark was the president of the Tucker Club of America.
Right.
In fact, the Tucker Automobile Club of America. And they merged with us. And now Mark is our senior Tucker advisor as well as a board member of the AACA Museum.
Oh, fantastic. I didn't realize that happened.
Yeah, yeah. So they were taken in as part of our umbrella. And they're part of the AACA Museum. And we are now the center of the Tucker universe. And we have people like Mark to help further the Tucker cause. And our anniversary event is coming up in mid-June, and Mark's here to talk about the wonderful program we have put together for the public to
yeah.
with these iconic cars.
I mean, it's not just, you know, there's a lot of things, and you can have a car on display, but you guys have done much more than this, Mark, for this event coming up. I mean, it's going to be immersive Tuckerville, right?
It will. We've got, there'll be 10 cars on display. So not only are you going to have an opportunity to see the very first Tucker production car, the first Tucker 48 on there, car number one, but you're also going to be able to see Tucker number 50, the final car off the assembly line.
Right.
And then several in between.
Sure.
The variations, you'll be able to observe the people that are going to be out here taking a look at these cars will really get a chance firsthand to see what went on over that very short period of time, roughly 8 months that they were building these cars and all the changes that took place.
Sure. And for those that don't know, I mean, there's rarity in the fact that they only build a few, but these things were technological marvels of the time. I mean, what's made a Tucker so special that they command the prices that they command nowadays?
Well, you know, it's really quite remarkable. If you take a look at what Preston Tucker and Alex Tremulis and the design staff put together in these automobiles, you see some very unique features that carry forward to today. So, for example, you have the first padded dashboard. You have four-wheel independent suspension, rear aluminum engine, a four-speed electronic pre-select transmission. Very, very unique system that they actually got the ideas from the cord, where you select a gear and it doesn't do anything until you touch the clutch.
Right.
And then it shifts for you. You've also got doors that are open into the roof line for easy entrance and exit. Interchangeable seats. You can swap front to rear in order to even the wear on seats.
That's brilliant.
It's really some wild stuff. You also have, you know, he paid a lot of attention to safety. And so you've got a pop-out safety windshield
right.
in these, which you didn't see in other cars of the time. And then extraordinary performance. Here is an almost 19-foot long car that was capable of doing 130 miles an hour.
Wow.
This is a four-door sedan in 1948 that would outrun just about every car on the road.
Right. Well, and a padded dash, you know, you mentioned the padded dash and people think, well, what's so special about that? That was a real safety thing though, because you had metal dashes before and you hit that face first. You wouldn't mind to have a little padding in there, right?
Very true.
And how are Tuckers to drive? Are they great to drive? Are they cumbersome? What do they feel like today?
Okay. So a Tucker that is set up correctly, and sorted out is an amazing vehicle to drive. I would liken it to a giant 356 Porsche on steroids.
What a great analogy. Yes. I like that a lot.
It is a very light front end, super easy to steer. The suspension is torsoelastic tubes or a torsoelastic slab. So right. It's rubber suspension. There are no springs.
Wow.
And so it gives you a very unique riding experience.
Sure, sure. And I'm learning more and more about Tuckers in the past couple of days, just kind of preparing for this. And one of the unique features about a Tucker, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the engine could be removed in a very short period of time if you needed to service it. And actually the idea was that they could replace the motor while they were sorting out your motor, and then you'd come back in and do the whole thing in reverse.
That was the idea. They wanted to have a very quickly replaceable drivetrain. So you brought your vehicle in for major service on the engine. They would give you a loaner engine instead of a loaner car.
I love it.
And you would drive away until your engine was serviced and put it back in.
Yeah, isn't that amazing? I mean, who'd have thunk, right? But, you know, I mean, interestingly, the Tucker wasn't killed because it was a poor car, right? I mean, the Tucker didn't survive because the big three didn't want it to survive, right? I mean, is that ultimately what it was, or
that's certainly the way the movie portrayed it,
right?
Okay, but it's not so much the reality of the way it was. I mean, there was a combination of factors that were kind of working against him at the time. He was undercapitalized, even though that they managed to raise with the IPO $26 million. That was not enough to launch a new car company. And and the Tucker Corporation suffered under a number of things. One, it was politically unpopular with the Senator Ferguson in Michigan, who thought that they were going to encroach upon the car companies.
Right.
But for the most part, the car companies were certainly aware of him, but really weren't that threatened. In fact, Ford was selling him parts and steering wheels, and Hudson was selling him parts, and Kaiser was selling him parts.
Sure.
So if they really felt that he was, that they wanted to run him out of business, they wouldn't be supporting him.
Right, exactly.
So I don't think that it was so much that the car companies wanted to run him out of business as much as it was a problem with undercapitalization, the problem with the press creating this issue of no confidence from the public because of the investigation, which turned out to be unsubstantiated, and he and his management team were acquitted of all charges. But when the SEC came down upon him at that period of time, and the story broke on the news before he was even aware that it was happening, it was pretty much a political and news hit job.
Sure, sure. I mean, you would think that such a great car like that would have been, you know, somebody would have said, hey, we'll just take all that and start building it under our name, or our Ford might take it, or Chrysler, or somebody else would have taken the car. But I guess there just wasn't enough there for anybody to take, right?
Well, here's the challenge. It would have cost them an enormous amount of money to make the changes in their product line to incorporate the things in place that Tucker had.
Right.
And that type of investment was deemed unnecessary at the time, since Tucker was off the table, so to speak.
Sure.
But they did go forward with adopting several of the things that were in place that he utilized. Now, keep in mind, too, that since Tucker was produced for such a short period of time, they really didn't have an opportunity to sort these things out fully.
Right.
If he had the opportunity to do so, then it certainly would have advanced much better. Another thing that you've got to keep in mind with this, too, is that this wasn't a little operation. He had 250 full-time engineers, more than Packard at the time.
Wow. And how do people find you if they're looking for something Tucker? Do you have a website that people can go to?
Absolutely. NostalgicMotoringLimited.com. We buy, sell, and restore all types of interesting collecting automobiles. You'll find certainly links to all the special Tucker stuff there as well.
Sure, sure. I guess there's a lot of information out there on Tuckers and out on the web and all of that. If you just Google it, I'm sure you can find lots of things. But it's like anything on the internet, you know, what's accurate and what's not. And that's where the AACA Museum comes in, because you can refute or dispute or tell people that that is true or not true on something, right?
Yeah, we field questions almost daily about the Tucker question.
Sure. And I imagine a lot of it is myth and legend and the movie based and all that stuff as well, too. But I would imagine that also, you know, I guess people, if somebody's thinking of buying a Tucker, they obviously want to do their due diligence and call you guys and call you, Mark, and learn a little bit more before they dive in and buy something that maybe wasn't the right car.
Indeed. Well, we're here to help, and we have spent an enormous amount of time trying to understand these cars better and make sure that they're preserved for the generations ahead to appreciate like we do.
Sure, sure. And you mentioned Rob Ida. He's an integral player in all of this, right? I mean, he's been involved with Tuckers for quite a while as well.
Well, his grandfather had a dealership.
Oh, wow.
Well, and that's how it started.
Wow. So that would have been, were the dealerships opened in 47, or did they open when the first cars came out of the factory? Or they opened a little early?
No, they started selling dealerships in 47. Right. So, people bought franchises in the anticipation of having cars to sell. And, initially, Preston would send out certain cars to dealerships so they could display them and demonstrate them. And then early on, I should say, as that moved along a bit, he was selling the cars to the dealerships. And so a few cars got sold through the dealerships. Most of the cars got sold at the liquidation auction.
Right.
When, following the closure of the company.
Right. How many dealers were there when they first started?
There was over 2,000.
And we have some of those contracts. I've read some of them. It's really interesting snapshot in history to review.
Wow. They were serious.
Yeah. They were serious about that.
And he was a hell of a salesman too, right? I mean, Preston Tucker, yes. to get 2,000 dealerships, that's got to be mighty impressive. So did any particular dealer sell like two or three, or who was the winner in that?
I don't know that there was a winner in that. In fact, if you speak to any of the descendants of the dealer holders, I think that they would say that there were more losers than winners. Yeah,
I would imagine. It'd be interesting to know, do you remember what the franchise cost was back then, Jeff? Was there a number that?
There was some suggested number. I can't remember. Do you remember what it was, Mark? What you needed in capital to incorporate?
I think it was $7,500.
Oh, wow. Of course, that was a lot of money in 1947. Yeah. We're just out of a war. Right. You know, but of course, I mean, it was a good time to be in the car business. It had some things going for it to be starting then. I mean, that was the start of an era of time that was as successful as we've ever seen in this country from, you know, after the war until through the 50s.
It was a time of growing prosperity. People had a lot of hope. People wanted to experience life. They had come through the war. They had still fresh memories of difficult times. And at this point, you know, the economy was growing. There was a big push for infrastructure and road building and highways and travel. Keep in mind, at that point in time, motoring was an activity.
Right.
The idea of having freedom from with your automobile was, you know, something that was really treasured. You know, now freedom to kids today is their telephone.
Right.
Well, then freedom was your automobile. And so it was such an integral part of your life that they marketed very specifically to people and certain groups. And the idea there was that you should find the right automobile that you connect with, because this was your connection to the outside world.
Sure, absolutely. Well, it sounds like, Mark, we could do this all day long, and you wouldn't be for a lack of any information. We really appreciate you being on. Jeff, tell us once again how people find out about this event and when the dates are and all that good stuff.
If you search Tucker 75th in the internet, we'll come up, but go directly to our museum website, aacamuseum.org. Join us on the 16th and 17th of June for a once-in-a-lifetime celebration of everything Tucker.
Yeah, I highly recommend everybody participate in this and go see it, because it's an amazing story, and we've learned a little bit about that today. And thanks so much to both of you guys for being here in person and online. And go back to your factory job, because I see you guys putting the bolt on the wrong place.
I've got work to do back here. make sure that you get out and get online and buy your tickets for this event. Seating is limited.
Absolutely.
It's well worth it.
Absolutely. And don't want to miss it on the sellout. So if you have any questions, podcast at classicautomall.com. And you can also visit our website, classicautomall.com. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
You are invited on a safari at Classic Auto Mall on a search for animals. Look closely and you might see a tiger, jaguar, and a cheetah or cougar as they try to catch a herd of impalas. And don't forget the wild mustangs and broncos, plus gazelle, rabbits, and rams. Instead of the zoo, you'll want to do your animal watching at Classic Auto Mall. It smells better, too.
When it comes to car magazines, are you tired of reading about mega-dollar collector cars you can't afford, or endless reporting on auctions and how-to tech stories that don't interest you? Then Crankshaft is the car magazine for you. Crankshaft is a 144-page softcover quarterly filled with all sorts of fascinating stories, the type of car features you won't find anywhere else. It features American and foreign cars, pre- and post-war era cars of distinction including sports cars, muscle cars, and regular family sedans too. To discover what many car enthusiasts are saying is the best car magazine ever published, you can purchase either a single copy for $12.95 plus $3 postage, or a one-year subscription, four issues, for $59.95. To order your copy, go to www.crankshaftmagazine.com. That's www.crankshaftmagazine.com.
Hey folks, this is Victor with the On Point with Victor show. Make sure you listen every Tuesday 1 to 2, only right here on America's Web Radio, the On Point with Victor show. Remember folks, I'm not angry, I'm just right. And you can find out why every Tuesday from 1 to 2, the On Point with Victor show, only right here on America's Web Radio.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
This is the Classic Auto Mall Best Of. Now here's part of another interview from Classic Auto Mall president and host, Stuart Howden, as he talks to one of his most tired guests.
Joining us via Zoom from Chattanooga, Tennessee, Mr. Corky Coker. How are you this morning, Corky?
I'm great. How are you, brother?
We are doing fantastic. You know, we've been talking about doing this for about a year and a half, and it's hard to get schedules and everybody on the same page and all that, but we're really glad to have you. I didn't know this about you. You were born in one of my favorite towns, and the reason it's my favorite town is my favorite company is located in your hometown, Mayfield Dairy Farm.
Oh yeah, man. You know, there's a bunch of folks that are Bluebell aficionados and they all these other ice cream. They ain't nothing like Mayfield's.
I'm with you 100%. I try to figure out a way to bring some home every time I come back to Pennsylvania because I love their ice cream sandwiches are the best and their brown cows are the best. And we could a whole show on Scotty Mayfield and the success of Mayfield Dairy, but. One of these days, the Pennsylvanians will get it. They don't quite understand food up here, Corky. It's not like in the South. So,
you know, I remember coming to Hershey back in the 60s and I'd go to Friendly's or something like that and ask for grits. And they said, well, what's that? Is that ground up corn husks?
Yeah, that's a perfect description of what they think it is. I'll never forget the first time I was here. We had a dealer auction and we had a cafeteria and the girl knew I was from the South, from Knoxville. And she said, oh, you're going to really love lunch tomorrow. She said, we're having chicken pot pie. And I said, oh, I love chicken pot pie. And she brings out this plate the next day and it's this soupy looking stuff with these round clumps of dough. I said, that's chicken and dumplings. She goes, no, that's chicken pot pie. I go, you don't know. They don't know.
So, it's got to be in a little round tin about that big so you can put it on a plate and cut it yourself. And, you know, steam comes out just like Mama used to make them.
You know, we could do a whole show on food, so I guess we somehow digressed here. But anyway, thanks again for being on the show. So tell me, where's the name Corky come from? I think I know the answer, but tell our listeners where that comes from.
Well, you know, my mama said, we're going to name him Joseph. And it was after the young man who had the coat of many colors in the Bible. So she wanted to have a Bible name. And it was the Jewish description or definition means productive. And I guess that kind of said something about me, too. But my dad was a big and very voracious Sunday morning paper reader, and he would read the Sunday morning comic strips, and one of those that still exists today is Gasoline Alley. And the guy that rode around in the cart picking up junk and parts and stuff name was, you know, there was, you know, there was several people in that, Gasoline Alley comic strip, but the name stuck. My dad says, you're going to name him Joseph. But we're going to always call him Corky, and it stuck.
Oh boy, it did ever. Have you ever met anybody else named Corky?
Oh yeah. Lots of folks. I've got a mason down here down the way that does some brickwork for me. And there's, you know, but there's not too many one name wonders in that have the name Corky in the automotive aftermarket and antique car hobby.
I would think so. I think that was true. We were speaking of the antique car and the car hobby. The Chattanooga Motoring Fest has really become a must attend event for everybody on their calendar. And you obviously are a big part of that. Tell us a little bit about how that all got going and where it's headed.
Well, we're going into our fourth year and we've got some really big plans. We've been talking to you guys at Classic Auto Mall about coming. We hope that you're coming with bells on, and we'd love to have you here. Our event happens downtown Chattanooga. We have a wonderful historic downtown that where, you know, we block off a number of city streets. There's restaurants on the streets. There's places for mama to go shopping when she gets tired of looking at hubcaps and checking out to make sure that the original tires are on all those collector cars.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's a really wonderful event. It happens the week after Hershey, the second week in October. You can find out anything you want to find out about it at ChattanoogaMotorCar.org. It's a really wonderful event. Sunday, we have our Chattanooga Motor Car Concourse on the grounds there in the West Village.
Right.
Downtown Chattanooga. It's around the Westin. My partner and friend Byron DeFore owns a number of the hotels down, and his brother Ken own a number of the hotels. We have a 1.62 mile racetrack on private property right downtown within two blocks of the Westin.
Right.
My museum is on Chestnut Street, next door to the Chattanooga Hamilton County Convention Center. Yeah. It will host the third year of the Meekum auction there. Yeah. So you guys can come down here and buy a lot of inventory and take it back to Pennsylvania to sell
to all the folks up here, right? If you've never been to Chattanooga, I was back there last year for the first time in hundreds of years before I was there last. And it's a wonderful town. It really has grown in a nice format and way that it's not overgrown and crazy busy like some of the places have gotten. But I mean, it's got the coolest downtown I've been to in a long time.
Well, we're very proud of Chattanooga, and we've got a city council and a county commission that work together, two county mayors that really support the Chattanooga Motor Car. We've got the World Rally Association coming down to race cars. They're going to have a headquarters in Chattanooga, and race those rally cars in Cherokee National Forest and some of the areas close to us. We've got, obviously, I mentioned this downtown racetrack. This year we have a very special event that I'm kind of sponsoring and heading up at the racetrack and on the show field also. It's Mercer versus Stutz.
Oh, I love it.
And we're going to have a whole group on the racetrack with Mercer's racing Stutz automobiles because, man, you know, you've got to be nuts to drive a Stutz, but it's worse if you drive a Mercer.
Oh, worse. That's a good Tennessee word. I like that a lot.
Yeah,
so right. is there talk of the track becoming a permanent type facility? Is that going to happen someday, or is it all going to be a street course like it has been in the past?
No, well, we've always had the majority of it on the Bend property, which is a development that they're building a whole West Village downtown next right. to the river with venues, and they've got a river going through it like down in San Antonio.
Sure.
It's probably an artificial river, but there's a battery producer there. There's talk of, local manufacturer automobiles maybe having a stronger presence downtown. So We think that there's a good possibility we will keep this racetrack on the facility downtown, and who knows what that might move to. If we've got a really wonderful looking track, it doubles into itself a lot. It's got some really cool chicanes. It goes through a huge big remnant of a building. We've got big pictures of some of the greats, drivers of the years, and it's called the Alley of the Greats. It's well thought out. We've got a children's area with a Ferris wheel. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's exciting. If you've never been to it, you owe it yourself to go. And your specialty when it comes to these is the pre-war, the big, like the Mercer and the Stutz and the Nybergs and all that. And I mean, those cars, those are not easy cars. You don't just get in and turn the key on one of those, right?
Well, you got to be a very smart individual. You've got to be athletically, you got to be handsome too, in your jumpsuits, all of that stuff to drive one of those cars. I'm just kidding. But it's a great fun time. We've got the ragtime racers. My friend Brian Blaine will come from California, and we'll have about 10 or 12 early nationals and Sturdivant. There's EMFs with Chalmers, a number of race cars like that that will be going around the track and doing the dance together, going around the track. It's a great fun time. And then, of course, we'll have Mercers and Stutzes, and then there'll be Porsches. And this year we've got a really wonderful grouping of about 30 of the greatest of the great Ferraris.
Really? Wow.
We've been sanctioned by our good friend Bill Marriott. Yeah. He has loaned us his name. He's got some really amazing Ferraris, and we're creating a club that's focused around Chattanooga. So all these folks will come to Chattanooga and be involved in showing off and driving their Ferraris. We've got Luft this time coming to the Porsche cars coming to set up a display downtown. Wow. We've got Canosa going to do a rally. Yeah. It's all happening in Chattanooga the week after Hershey's, second weekend in October. So be here and, have fun with us.
Absolutely. So driving one of these pre-war cars at, let's say, 70 or 80 miles an hour feels like 200 in any other car. Is it really?
It does. There were a lot of cars. If you look up some of the records in 1911, 12, 13, some of the average speeds were, 70, 80 miles an hour. And back then, that's when racers were real men. And today we honestly, with some of these early race cars, we wear safety helmets and we wear jumpsuits, et cetera, but we do not wear seat belts because these cars, if you happen to wreck them or flip them, you want to move quickly away from the automobile.
Absolutely. That makes 100% sense. So, and I love that, like you were just talking about, the period correct attire of your guys. Do you visit every thrift store in America to find this stuff? Where do you find that stuff?
You can find it on eBay. You can find it on, there's a really wonderful website called Historical Emporium that sells a lot of stuff. You can buy dusters. You can buy, my wife and I, when we attend concourses all over, we've got a number of brass cars, and we love to dress up in period clothing, and people are just, they just gravitate to our car. At Amelia this last year, we showed our 1911 Top 35R Mercer race about. Right. And, I had on my vintage boots and, she wore a big hat. And
right.
We have a great time and people enjoy seeing us.
Absolutely. And do you participate in other historic races around the country, or is it just in Chattanooga? Yeah.
This year in June, I'll be at Indy, and, we've got some, in August, we'll be at Laguna Seca for, the Monterey Historics.
I bet a Mercer through the corkscrew is pretty fun at Laguna.
Oh my goodness. Mercer is the best no matter what you're doing with it. Actually, in Chattanooga last year, we had a long straightaway on a city street, and we determined to get the race course adapted so it's all on private property, but I was doing about 70 miles an hour in that 1911 Mercer down Riverfront Parkway.
Wow.
But, the days and the the wonderful people I met, car people are the best people in the world. And, you know, I just have to say that, God's really blessed me to grow up in a family that love God, love vintage cars, and love their family. And, you know, we're still that way. I love car people. I love to help folks. Even if they bought something from Coker Tire Company next door and they mess on you, I still get involved and try to fix it, but, because it's my, it was my baby.
Hey, Corky, thanks so much for being on the show today. We really appreciate it and look forward to seeing you in October down in Chattanooga.
The Classic Auto Mall is located not far from Audubon, Pennsylvania, named after James Audubon, the famous ornithologist. And there's probably no better place for bird watching. Look there, a flock of thunderbirds. Of course, who doesn't love the powerful firebirds? Studebaker lark and hawks, Buick skylarks, plus AMC eagle, and the difficult-to-catch roadrunner. Oh, there's no better place for bird watching than Classic Auto Mall.
Call J.C. Taylor today for a competitive quote on collector car insurance. Give your most prized possessions the attention that they deserve. You'll receive agreed value coverage, giving you the peace of mind to know you're always protected. J.C. Taylor has been supporting the hobby with reliable service that has lasted for six decades. Call 888-ANTIQUE or visit jctaylor.com/awr to get a quote today. That's 888-268-4783. Or visit jctaylor.com/awr. Drive through time with peace of mind. JC Taylor.
When it comes to car magazines, are you tired of reading about mega dollar collector cars you can't afford, or endless reporting on auctions and how-to tech stories that don't interest you? Then Crankshaft is the car magazine for you. Crankshaft is a 144-page softcover quarterly filled with all sorts of fascinating stories, the type of car features you won't find anywhere else. It features American and foreign cars, pre- and post-war era cars of distinction including sports cars, muscle cars, and regular family sedans too. To discover what many car enthusiasts are saying is the best car magazine ever published, you can purchase either a single copy for $12.95 plus $3 postage, or a one-year subscription, four issues, for $59.95. To order your copy, go to www.crankshaftmagazine.com. That's www.crankshaftmagazine.com.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Don't forget to visit us, ClassicAutoMall.com on the web, and come see us here in person. Our hours are on our website, where we were just reminiscing about our parking lot with our guest today, Brock Yates, Jr. How are you, sir?
I am fine, thank you.
We've just met today for the first time, and we're already dear friends. So you know how that works.
There's thousands of dollars in stupid activities. And say, well, I'm going to give some of it to charity.
Yeah, right.
I've wasted billions and billions of dollars. And here's $5. No, I'm kidding.
Well, you know, it's funny, and one of my favorite sayings is racing costs the same today as it did 20 years ago, every penny you got.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So for those of you that don't know, Brock Yates Jr.'s father was Brock Yates Sr., who was one of my favorite writers back in the day with Car and Driver magazine. And he reminded me a lot. He was so irreverent in so many ways. He reminded me a lot of Hunter Thompson. He was just that. He was gonzo journalism for cars.
He was. And he was untethered.
Right. I love that, untethered.
I mean, that was a great thing about Hunter. Hunter was one of my great heroes.
Right.
And he was allowed to write what he wanted to write. And Brock was lucky to be in the golden age of automotive journalism where you could piss off the advertisers now and then to tell the truth. And it helped them make better cars. Now, you cannot say bad things about a new car as an automotive journalist, otherwise you lose your job.
Yeah, exactly.
You lose your sponsor, you lose your job.
The Cannonball Run, such an iconic race that became a series of movies. The first one was your dad and Dan Gurney. And if, those of you don't know, Cannonball Run was a race from New York City to Redondo Beach, California.
No, Cannonball Run was the movie.
Right.
The Cannonball Sea to Shining Sea Memorial Trophy Dash.
Right.
Was the race that Brock started in spring of 71. And I was on it.
Right. I heard that.
And Steve Smith and Jim Williams, who later became the art director for Car and Driver, we all showed up to Red Ball Garage expecting other people to show up. And, of course, they all wimped out. So we took this poor Dodge van all the way to Redondo Beach in 40 hours and 51 minutes.
Wow.
And it was an amazing trip. It was amazing because every time I drive cross country subsequently, I realize how much the world has changed.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it's, yeah, we drove into Albuquerque and over the top of the pass. I don't know if you've ever driven into Albuquerque, but the whole valley is filled with lights.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just an enormous city.
Right.
And when we drove in, there was a little tiny spot of lights at the bottom, and Route 66, you had to follow Route 66, we had to stop and turn right at a bar. That is no longer the case.
Right. And could you, I mean, how did you even find gas back then?
That was a real concern because there were no 24-hour gas
stations. Sheets and Wawas.
Yeah, I mean, there, you know, on the main roads, there were some people, you know, there were some, and we, you know, you didn't dare let the tank get very low. And, of course, you carried a couple of gallons with you just in case.
Just in case, right.
But, no, it was fabulous. But anyway, as soon as Brock wrote the story about our adventure, got a note from Oscar Kowalski, who has just recently passed, and saying, we challenge you, but we require pole position.
Right. So they get to leave first.
Right. Obviously, because they're Polish.
Yeah.
And Brock somehow wheedled a Ferrari from Kurt White.
Right.
And at the last minute, Dan Gurney acquiesced to show up.
Wow.
And that was a very last-minute deal. There was a chance Brock wouldn't even have gone.
Gone at all.
Yeah.
I've got to imagine that, you know, tiredness and all that factors in, but reliability had to be as big a factor as anything back then, or was it?
I don't remember the long... I mean, cars broke.
Right.
But... I mean, it's highway miles are probably the easiest miles on a car, period.
Even if you're going fast.
If you're going fast. Yeah. One of the first cannonballs, or one laps rather, subsequent event.
Right.
A dealer showed up with two Halpas, Lamborghini Halpas.
Right, right.
And he sold them as used after the event. He said, those were the most reliable cars I ever sold.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, because, you know, this nice, easy break-in, you know.
Sure.
Constant running miles.
Right.
You know, yes, sir, you know, we had dogs hit and, you know, things, you know, things happened.
And possum.
Yeah, and, you know, transmissions fall out.
Sure.
And, you know, no, but that's the stuff you see normally on anyway.
Yeah, anytime you're driving a car. This is the Classic Auto Mall podcast from the Classic Auto Mall studio in Morgantown, Pennsylvania. Brock Yates Jr. is here in the studio with us, and we were talking about the Cannonball Run, and just off the air, we were talking about my father-in-law was actually in that movie. Mel Tillis was in Cannonball Run 1 and 2, and in Smokey the Bandit 2. And I think your dad was involved in all three of those, wasn't he, or two of them anyway?
Brock and Hal Needham were very close.
Yeah.
And Brock had written as practice Smokey the Bandit 2.
Right.
Or at least had a hand in it.
Sure.
He then wrote Cannonball Run, the first one. And when I say he wrote it, he got the credit for it. It was rewritten thereafter, and then they included Jackie Chan so they could, you know, have the Eastern market. And, you know, all kinds of things happened. And it was originally cast for
Steve McQueen.
Steve McQueen developed cancer and wasn't able to do it. And Burt was just an opportunist enough that he swore he'd never do another car movie until Hal said, I'll pay you $5 million.
Of course, you know, my favorite Burt Reynolds car movie is not that one. It's White Lightning.
White Lightning.
Or Gator. Gator was pretty good.
God, my favorite car movie is Driven. No, I'm kidding. Really. No.
Exactly.
Actually, so, White Line Fee.
I forgot about that one. So, in your opinion, or maybe in Brock's thoughts back in the day, how would Cannonball have been different with Steve McQueen in it? Would it have been a different movie?
It would have been a completely different movie. Brock wrote it more like, there was a movie called Cannonball and Gumball Rally.
Right, I remember Gumball Rally.
That came out previously.
Right.
And based on the fact that the Cannonball was a news event, he wasn't able to stop them from doing it.
Gotcha. Right, because it's public domain.
Yeah. And those two movies actually captured the spirit of Cannonball better than Cannonball Run.
Wow.
And Brock had written it more as a, you know, not a documentary, but a,
sure,
more of a action movie rather than a cameo-laden movie.
Yeah, that was and a little was, overdone in that.
Yeah, it was really. I mean, I have seen Cannonball Run twice.
Right.
Brock saw most of it the first time, and that was it, as far as I know.
Wow.
And any credits he got in Cannonball 2 and 3 were contractual, not his actual... his actual participation, because he was really pissed.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah, and he caught a lot of flack from his friends because, you know, he's cashing in on Hollywood,
right,
destroying the image of Cannonball.
Although it must have been a pretty nice paycheck to get through a number of years.
I think it did.
Yeah,
yes.
So nothing wrong with that, I guess. If, you know, it depends on, hey, listen, we're all in different things for different
we're
reasons.
We're all whores in, you know, in the bus. You know, all whores in this bus. I mean, we all, you know, we all cater to something. We all need something. We all
absolutely
do what we need to do when we need to do it.
And listen, if I could be a part of a movie and be set for the rest of my life financially, I'd probably do it regardless of, even if it was, you know, it's pretty amazing that, I mean, even back then to get away with it, but even in later years, I mean, I know that you're doing the One Lap, which is, you know, very charity based and, but it's not,
it's safe and sane.
It's safe and sane. You're going fast on places where you're supposed to go fast, a racetrack,
right,
and not on the streets and all of that. And I mean, I think I read somewhere where Brock finally said, you know, he saw some guy at a Lamborghini with four escort radar detectors mounted in various places.
And that was the car in the movie.
Yeah. And it was like, this is getting out of hand.
Yeah, she did. And it was 1981 and just said, no, you know, we're going to put a bullet in Cannonball. We're going to hurt somebody.
Yeah, somebody's going to, and then it'll lose any.
And subsequently, there was a U.S. Express and a bunch of recreational or social events that,
right,
Cannonball 3000 and Cannonball Run and some other, and Fireball and other ones that were not sanctioned by anybody, that were not particularly well run nor safe.
Sure.
It was basically a staged rally between hotels where you drink heavily and do the same thing the next day.
Sure.
And I was quoted by the Toronto Sun years ago when the Cannonball 3000 was going through Canada, much to the Canadians' disgust, about what I thought of it. And I said, yeah, those events are run by young, pretentious, rich folks, you know, that are bored.
That are bored. And have nothing better to do. Can anybody join the One Lap deal? I mean, can anybody?
Anybody with a car? Anybody with some racing experience? Well, yeah, track experience.
So you'd have to go to two different schools, which would be like a, I don't know, Skip Barber?
We're much more flexible than NASA, SECA.
Oh, gotcha.
Chin, Hooked on Driving.
Yeah.
All those things provide in classroom training and on racetrack training. And we've managed to, since I took it over from my father, kind of rebuilt it away from the cult of personality, which he was, right, such a giant human, you know, giant, sure, presence, to a pretty amazing event right now. It's a standalone. We, you know, I will open up the registration at the end of August, and in 2 days I'll have a wait list.
Wow. Once again, thank you, Brock Yates Jr., for being on the show, and we'll see you next time on the Classic Auto Mall podcast. Catch you then.
You've been listening to the Classic Auto Mall podcast with your host, Stuart Howden. Executive producer, Steve Saffair. Produced and engineered by yours truly, J.R. Russ. Thanks for listening and sharing the Classic Auto Mall podcast. Available on ClassicAutoMall.com, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Questions, answers, or comments? Write us at podcast@ClassicAutoMall.com. And if you want to talk about buying a classic car seen on our website, you're looking for a particular vehicle, or want to consign your classic classic for sale, write us at info@classicautomall.com or call and talk to a real live classic car specialist at 888-227-0914. That's 888-227-0914. Music courtesy of the Pat Travers Band. For tour dates, contact, and stuff, visit pattravers.com. The Classic Auto Mall Podcast is produced by Car Smarts Media. Copyright 2023. All rights reserved. The Classic Auto Mall is like going to the greatest indoor car showroom in the country. With more than 1,000 classic and collectible vehicles for sale via consignment in our 8-acre climate-controlled showroom, we've got something for everyone. We're open to the public most days. Plus, you can easily search our inventory online at classicautomall.com. Buying and selling via consignment is safe, easy, and secure. Plus, we advertise, sell, and ship worldwide. Find your dream classic vehicle at classicautomall.com.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.